Alternative radio. A classic, Michael Parenti was put forward by David Bersamian. Parenti died at 92, I guess I heard him, Bersamian say. He was on U of I campus back in the Vietnam era. I remember him getting beat up and remember him leading the embargo of supplies into the Illini Union, garbage in, garbage out. No, that isn't very clear. Anyway, I was working there at the time, so I had a first front row seat of the activities at the vending room at the Illini Union student job. All right, my name is Paul Muth. That's enough biography today, but it's well worth checking out. Library of Talks by Parenti was something like 64. Maybe it was less than that, but it was sizable up there with Chomsky's library on alternative radio of talks. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. I like to do a rundown. I wish I was announcing Breaking the Sound Barrier essay by Amy Goodman, because she would have collected a lot of what happened this week. And her coverage, and there was some great coverage of Minneapolis. I'm short on that. I've been talking about having an interview with a person that lives in that neighborhood, but everything is so fraught right now. There have been episodes where people have been, this happened in Ann Arbor early on, a demonstration, even before the shootings, where a woman who was protesting was almost arrested on camera. The camera was still rolling, so there is footage of this woman being arrested right after doing a person on the street interview with a local TV station. In Minneapolis, I read that a couple of firms are being audited for their employees, which, you know, that's a practice that ICE has done in the past. It's not grabbing people off the street, but it's selective. It's a small family business where a woman had just done a TV interview. All of a sudden, that was announced that they were going to get an audit of their employees. So looks like retaliation. They must have had a database list of who they were going to select, and that one popped up because a woman had been vocal. Perhaps it was in from previous activities by that firm in support of the anti-ICE movement in Minneapolis. Well, I do have something on that in the sense that going to play the Bruce Springsteen song that he played in Minneapolis. Was it just yesterday, the day before, perhaps? I thought it was a pop-up concert, but it was a benefit concert that he showed up at and played the song. Maybe he did some others as well. But let's get an underwriting announcement in here. A couple of community based ones. Maybe I should do them both together because I do forget these. And it's important for small businesses, organizations. I always call out the chess club and see whether they could do an underwriting announcement. I don't know. Maybe they have enough people playing online or something. I already gave a disclaimer. Did I do an official legal ID? This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana listener-sponsored volunteer-operated radio. Do have some Umia. I'm happy to say that he's generated 5 short commentaries in the last week since I looked, and means his health is good, I guess, or maybe that it's just there's so much going on. So we'll have that after this.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Make It Champaign-Urbana. Make It Champaign-Urbana provides programs to assist new residents in getting connected to the community through the Champaign Welcome Crew. Are you passionate about the community? As an ambassador, you can help make a difference to new residents by answering their questions and sharing your community experiences. Ready to join over 50 ambassadors making a difference? For more information, visit makeitcu.com.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible, in part, by the Champaign Park District. Box Lunch is back. On select Fridays, talented local artists will fill the historic Springer Cultural Center with a wide variety of music. Presented by WEFT. For more information, champaignparks.org.
Well, I announced two things were coming up next, Streets of Minneapolis and Mumi Abu-Jamal. So why don't we hear the boss first? Not a dried prune of the rock element or something that Trump said the last time they tangled last year.
Through the winter's ice and cold, down Nicollet Avenue, a city of flame fought fire and ice neath an occupier's boots. King Trump's private army from the DHS, guns belted to their coats, came to Minneapolis to enforce the law, or so their story goes. Against smoke and rubber bullets, in the dawn's early light, citizens stood for justice, their voices ringing through the night. And there were bloody footprints where mercy should have stood, dead left to die on snow-filled streets, Alex Pretty and Renee Good. Or Minneapolis, I hear your voice singing through the bloody mist. We'll take our stand for this land and the strength. Of Minneapolis. Trump's federal thugs beat upon his face and his chest. Then we heard the gunshots, and Alex Pretty lay in the snow dead. Their claim was self-defense, sir. Just don't be your eyes. It's our blood and bones and these whistles and phones against Miller and Noam's dirty lies. Oh, I'm Minneapolis, I hear your voice crying through the bloody mist. We'll remember the names of those who died on the streets of trample on our rights. If your skin is black or brown, my friend, you can be questioned or deported on sight. In our chains of ice out now, our city's heart and soul persist. Through broken glass and bloody tears on the streets of Minneapolis. Of Minneapolis, we'll remember the names of those who died on
Normalizing the visuals of military masked, heavily armed troops on American streets. And, you know, this is a man who has a fixation about the military. Even though he did not serve in the military, people forget that he went to a military school in his teen years, his high school. And I think it left an imprint on him, on the potential power that the military wields. And he knows that it's, if not the, it is one of the most powerful institutions in any society. To give that kind of, first of all, money, then power to mass men really raises, for the first time in American history openly, the specter of secret troops. You know, unknown troops who are at war with American democracy. I think that's a stunning kind of step backward in a way that this country has rarely, if ever, entertained with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
We live in a country where the Supreme Court, which is the highest judicial power in the United States of America, essentially gave unlimited power, right, and immunity to the president, you know, on the basis of party affiliation. And if anyone had talked about this kind of power being conferred upon Barack Hussein Obama, people would have been shot, and people would have been out into the street demonstrating against King Barack. But the Supreme Court may not be right, and has been quite wrong in the history of the United States. That doesn't change their power of finality. When they rule, other courts are silent, even when they know it is erroneous and based on a false apprehension of what the law should be. The law is what the Supreme Court says the law is. And therein lies the problem. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I needed to hear something else with some composure after the boss's thing. Amazing to hear it, think that he played that in the streets of Minneapolis in the last couple of days. That's Mumia Abu-Jamal, a longtime political prisoner. I'm glad he's got, that's two out of the five commentaries he's dropped in the last week. He's responding to the occasion, I guess. I didn't actually give a rundown. I have a segment from, a couple of segments from Project Censored, another show from out at KPFA. Don't know whether I'll have time for both of them or even all of it. So also I'm going to play something from David Sirota's Lever Time. It's actually not him voicing the material. I've been meaning to do something about cryptocurrency for a while, and this is a pretty good intro. They have a model of podcasts that's sort of listener-supported and hybrid with the ads. You can subscribe. They have a great series on how calculated, you know, the Powell memo, talking about basically establishing oligarchic control of the political system. That's not their gloss, but that's pretty good. But it covers the way the process was done. It's not a conspiracy. It was done at think tanks and congressional lobbying and media strategies. So I won't often get to Lever Time, but I do recommend that series highly, and tracked all that they've been doing. But like I said, I've been listening to a lot of Bloomberg news through Trump's visit to Davos. I thought I'd listen to how the business class was talking about it, and it really established my view that basically the Greenland gambit was pretty much vetoed by the combination. It's usually the bond market, but when the bond market and the stock market both crash and gold spikes, it got Trump's or maybe some of his acolytes' attention that this was perhaps too destabilizing, which might be reassessed, I suppose, by them all, if he needs another diversion of one kind or another. Took military and tariffs off the table. What does he have left? His power of moral suasion. Okay. So we're going to get to the segment with this scholar on ICE and Border Patrol and the incarceral part of it. People are making a lot about how the forces are being increased by this big, beautiful, ugly bill. But the building that's going on and the contracts being let to private prison entrepreneurs, if that's what they're called, is fundamental. This guy is sort of a human geographer, but he's studied the... anyway, I'll let the host here do the introduction. Again, this is from Project Censored. I clipped another thing. That I left the storyboard for it in this, thinking I would play this... at least an excerpt of this thing about AI manipulation and generally the meme clickbait culture that we're in, where people don't even care if they think, if you know that it's the stuff's fake, it's just if it gets the click and they make their money and establish the ideological view that they're propagating, I suppose, in some cases. It works for them. All right, here's a bit of that.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I am your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, along with Mickey Huff. In the first part of the program this week, we welcome back political and legal geographer Dr. Austin Coker to talk about the immigration news that never makes the news. Dr. Coker talks about overcrowded and deadly detention centers, the 287G clause that transforms your local law enforcement into ICE officers, the fundamental flaw in the U.S. immigration legal system, and how we shouldn't think of borders as a matter of what they are, but rather what they do in service of the state. Next up, my co-host Mickey Huff sits down with frequent guest and political analyst Nolan Higdon to dissect some recent news, focusing especially on AI. What can history tell us about the unintelligence of artificial intelligence? How deep fakes are crowbarring the political divide even further and deeper, the corporate capture of the classroom, and more. That's coming up on this week's episode of Project Censored.
Burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity citizens, and the ties with a master thief. Combine, conquer, steal.
Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I am your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, and here is some of the news that didn't make the news for the week of January 26th, 2026. In reporting by local independent outlets, ICE is posing as utility workers in order to kidnap migrants in Oregon. Utility companies published advisories to customers, making it clear how their contractors dress, and that they would, in fact, never randomly ask to gain immediate entry into a customer's home. These tactics follow a long trend of ICE officers failing to honestly identify themselves, actions that have gone totally unaddressed by higher-ups who continue to claim that ICE agents have full immunity, no matter what. Relatedly, 404 Media reported last week that feds have created a drone no-fly zone to stop people from filming ICE. It not only applies within 3,000 feet of Department of Homeland Security facilities, but also to mobile assets, meaning the skies up to a half a mile from ICE vehicles in Minneapolis, for example, could fall under this new jurisdiction. The order replaces an old order that only applied to static military bases and Department of Energy sites. With ICE constantly doing raids all over the country in unmarked vehicles dressed up as anything but ICE, Such orders aren't just a gross infringement on our First Amendment, but purposefully impossible to follow and too easy to enforce. In reporting from Mondo Weiss, 2025 saw an unprecedented level of violence and ethnic cleansing by Israel in the West Bank. In 2025 alone, Israeli settlers wiped 13 rural Palestinian communities off the map, 190 families, 1,090 people displaced. Israeli settlers launched more than 1,800 attacks in 2025, killing 240 Palestinians, injuring 838, with over 35,000 trees destroyed. It's important to remember that these numbers don't just denote lives, each one being a world unto themselves. It also represents the social fabric, the culture and livelihoods, the land and home places. For a genocidal regime, it is not enough to kill people, it must also kill memory. And this is why reporting from Palestine is so vital from Palestinians. It is quite literally an act of resisting erasure. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israeli gunfire and shelling killed at least 20 more Palestinians last week, while at least one infant died of exposure as Israel continues to block vital food, medical, and shelter supplies. Satellite imagery from Dropsite News also shows an area in Rafah where Israel has demolished remaining structures, cleared the rubble, and compacted the earth to allow for new structures. In other words, a concentration camp within a concentration camp. This falls in line with statements made by the likes of Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz, who spoke of a humanitarian city site that would house all of Gaza's population. The site being cleared is roughly a square kilometer. This comes at a time when Israel, besides violating the so-called ceasefire at least 1,200 times, also banned some 37 aid organizations from operating in Gaza at the start of the year. When taken together with other news from the ground and Trump's on-brand reverse-titled Board of Peace, it's quite clear that the genocide has not ended, but rather shifted into a new phase. And speaking of news on the ground, Israel killed another three journalists in a targeted airstrike as they were documenting the situation on the ground at the so-called Netzarim Corridor, the Israeli militarized line that separates northern Gaza from southern Gaza. So far, corporate so-called journalists have not reported on this or decried the killing of journalists. And finally, I'd like to share a few lines from the beautiful and necessary reporting by Margaret Kiljoy, who was on the ground in Minneapolis. Quote, half the street corners around here have people from every walk of life, including Republicans, standing guard to watch for suspicious vehicles, which are reported to a robust and entirely decentralized network that tracks ICE vehicles and mobilizes responders. I've been actively involved in protest movements for 24 years. I have never seen anything approaching this scale. It's genuinely a leaderless or leaderful movement, decentralized in a way that the state is absolutely unequipped to handle. There are a few basic skills involved, and so people teach each other those skills, and people are collectively refining them. When I asked an organizer what they wanted to see out of press coverage, they told me they wanted people to see the beautiful things they are building here, and not just the worst stories. What people are doing here is beautiful. It's a tragic beauty, but a real one, end quote. And that's some of your news that didn't make the news for the week of January 26, 2026. Now on to this week's program.
We'll take a pause here because that segment on the West Bank reminded me I was going to announce that I haven't established the time. I haven't done any pre-interviews or listened to the talks that were given. There was a contingent of Catholic worker activists that went to the West Bank recently. I guess it was a really torturous trip, and some of them are going to talk about their experiences. That'll be happening in the community at some point, too, but I hope to get them on the radio in the next couple of weeks. Maybe as early as tomorrow, but I haven't done the groundwork yet on that. It's been a whirlwind. So let's continue with the Project Censored segment.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield. And we're very glad to welcome back to the program Dr. Austin Coker, who is a political and legal geographer studying the theories, laws, and institutional practices behind immigration enforcement. The research focuses on the political and legal geography of immigration enforcement, examining topics such as mass immigrant surveillance, the digitization of asylum processes, and the impact of immigration policies on vulnerable populations. He is the assistant research professor in the Office of Research and Creative Activity in the S.I. Newhouse of Public Communication at Syracuse University, affiliated faculty member with the Department of Geography at the Maxwell School, and an affiliated expert at the Institute for Democracy, Journalism, and Citizenship. He's also a research fellow at American University Center for Latin American and Latino Studies in the Immigration Lab and somehow has time to sit down and talk to us. So, Austin, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I wanted to start off, I mean, on January 10th, we're recording this on Tuesday, January 20th, so folks know. Back on January 10th, you noted that ICE had already reported its fourth in-custody death in 2026 and that no media outlets had reported it. On January 18th, they reported their sixth in-custody death, and that's roughly one person killed every 72 hours in these so-called detention centers. 2025 was a particularly deadly year. A reported 32 people died in ICE custody last year. That's the highest number since 2004. What's causing this? What are these folks dying of?
Well, as far as we can tell, based on the research we've done in the past in the immigration world, detention deaths are largely almost exclusively preventable. But the truth is, when you go from detaining 40,000 people to over 70,000 people a day, and you scale up that quickly, the basic infrastructure that you need to support people's basic medical health can't scale that quickly with it. And these are not facilities that are really committed in, as part of their mission, providing, you know, a lot of them are for-profit facilities or local and state facilities that are not technically for-profit, but are making money off of holding immigrant detainees. And their goal is really how much money can they get out of this, not how well do they take care of people who are detained. So that's really what's driving this. And just more fundamentally, it's just reckless growth, reckless immigration enforcement that's more aggressive and with less oversight than we've seen for as long as I've been doing this. So it's sort of inevitable. It's sort of, you know, anybody who understands basic systems theory knows if you scale up in a reckless way, any kind of institution that has this much power over marginalized people's lives, people are going to die as a result of that. So even though we can't predict any individual death per se, it is entirely predictable and entirely foreseeable. And folks that you and I know and myself in public venues have been warning about this coming down the line for a while, and now we're seeing it.
Yeah, and I know that another issue with just, you know, kidnapping people sort of willy-nilly off the streets is that a lot of these detention centers are operating far above capacity. And at the same time, there's a push to build more because, of course, the problem is not that you're kidnapping people. It's that there's not enough places to put them. So what does that situation look like? I mean, where do you put people when you don't have anywhere to put them?
Well, what the administration is doing is, you know, basically building overnight these, you know, tent facilities. That's one of the ways that they do this. In fact, two of the deaths so far have happened at what's called Mountain East facility. It's a military base in El Paso. And that is a tent facility. You know, it doesn't necessarily have like hard walls and ceilings that, you know, that you be familiar with in even a regular detention facility, which is not good. Florida has also built very quickly earlier last year, built this facility called, that is the official name of it, as they've chosen to call it, is Alligator Alcatraz. In the Everglades, they built it very quickly. They skirted all kinds of environmental regulations and laws, so really massive ecological damage to it, among other things, which is a thing that people don't often think about. All of our immigration enforcement policies and detention policies have actually really large ecological impacts. But that facility was built very quickly and staffed very quickly without much training. And all the accounts that we have of people who've been through there say that it's just absolutely horrible conditions, super, super hot, totally inadequate medical care. So we hear a lot of the same things. But yeah, the administration is trying to build as much facilities as possible so that they can build new, they can build these tent facilities, or they can latch on to state and local law enforcement agencies that may have extra beds, as they refer to them euphemistically, beds in their local jail or other facilities that they can effectively house immigrants for the federal government. And that's really important to understand, because the better we understand the immigrant detention industrial complex, the more we can figure out how to make interventions. And so knowing that the Trump administration needs all of this extra space gives us the opportunity to say, okay, if there's a detention center coming to a town or county near me, how do we make an intervention and say, hey, we do not want our taxpayer dollars, we do not want our local officials participating in this unethical and, in my view, unreasonable enforcement regime?
Absolutely. And I want to, because you mentioned using existing prisons or collaborating with law enforcement, and this is something that has not gotten, in my opinion, nearly enough coverage in media. The 287G program, and, you know, we oftentimes talk about the deadly exchange between the Israeli forces training with our law enforcement, and I feel like this might be known as the deadly collaboration. This is a partnership between local and law enforcement and ICE, which provides, as I understand it, some really scary overlap in terms of jurisdiction. But there's also like actual financial incentives in it for police departments and then some. Could you talk about this deadly collaboration known as the 287G program and how we see it manifesting? And if those ways are different than what we were seeing prior to Trump's presidency?
Yes, the 287G program, well, I should say Section 287G of the Immigration and Nationality Act, that's where that program comes from. That was added in 1996 through bipartisan immigration reform and signed by a Democratic president, Bill Clinton. But it was not really used that much until the post-9/11 Bush era and then Obama era. Basically, what the law says is it says federal law enforcement agencies, immigration enforcement agencies, sorry, can work with local law enforcement, but that there has to be an agreement. You can't just have the federal immigration agents working with local law enforcement agencies and giving local law enforcement agencies immigration authority. And that's really what the law does. The law basically says ICE can pass on its authority to local law enforcement, and local cops and sheriffs can kind of go around acting like immigration enforcement officers. The fact that that's even a possibility is, you know, deeply problematic. The idea that your local law enforcement officers would be doing the federal government's job for them is just kind of absurd and has all kinds of problems. This program really ramped up at the end of the Bush administration, early Obama administration, and it was part of this big movement in federal, state, and local law enforcement to collaborate together across all these institutions. There's all this analysis that came out of 9/11 that said law enforcement are not working together enough. This was part of that. It was part of the anti-immigrant backlash, you know, that happened after 9/11. You and I think both remember that weirdly, we had this tragedy on American soil. And instead of addressing actually the underlying issues that led to that, our elected officials said, oh, great, we'll just blame all of the immigrants, which was absurd. But that's what it became. It became every immigrant now is a terrorist. And 287G was part of that whole push. Now, 287G has sort of evolved over its lifetime. It was really aggressive in the early Obama years. It sort of died down for a little while, but it really came back during Trump 1. The Biden administration did not do what they promised. President Biden, when he was candidate Biden, said that they were going to end all of these 287G agreements between federal and local law enforcement. They didn't. They just left it intact. And then Trump came back this time more aggressive than ever. And I'll tell you the thing that's probably the most important thing for people to understand, there was this very controversial aspect of 287G where, you know, normally for a while, the main way that ICE and cops would collaborate is, okay, once you book someone into the local jail, ICE can go and get them. You know, local jails would hold people for ICE. There are aspects of that which were deeply unconstitutional because they were holding them without charge. So big habeas corpus issue there. But there was this other part where ICE was giving law enforcement officers the explicit ability to go out and ask people on the street, you know, in the course of doing traffic enforcement, answering a 911 call, all this. Just your local cop, your local sheriff would be able to ask people about immigration. That was so controversial and so dangerous and so damaging that not only were communities concerned about it, law enforcement agencies said, we don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole because, okay, I have a lot of critiques of law enforcement agencies and history of policing in America. However, what law enforcement officers themselves have told me when I've interviewed them is they need some kind of working relationship with the community there to implement their version of public safety. And that means you can't just alienate all your communities. You actually have to be able to talk to people. And if immigrants, and especially if undocumented immigrants, aren't going to talk to law enforcement view that, many law enforcement agencies view that as a problem, not as a solution. So they didn't necessarily want this. So that program that was called the task force model, that went away. The Obama administration abolished that part of that program. The thing that's changed this time that people really need to understand is that the task force model is back, and it makes up about half of all of these over 1,200 287G agreements across the country. So what they've done is basically roll out the most dangerous, the most controversial part of 287G and make that the norm. So it really is fair to say these days that 287G, whatever its history has been, it is absolutely a program to turn your local law enforcement into ICE officers. And you may never see someone with a federal badge, you know, but that person who's, you know, on the street and wearing a police officer's uniform, you may as well consider them an ICE officer. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of cities across the country.
Which, of course, makes it more difficult for community members to recognize if ICE is in their
exactly.
community because if it's just
yes.
your... I just want to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio, and I am your co-host this week, Eleanor Goldfield, along with Mickey Huff, and we are speaking to political and legal geographer Dr. Austin Coker. So I want to kind of shift to the legal side of things as much as there is.
Yeah.
Something that the corporate media has not covered at all is this horrific trend of children being forced to appear in court after being ripped from their families, children as young as 4, and being forced to stand before an immigration judge. And these judges who... as you pointed out, like several have been fired, but according to legal theory, a judge should be impartial, right? Like should not have vested interests in either side. They're actually employed by the prosecution, as in like they're employed by the U.S. Attorney General. And I know I can't curse, but what the, like what is going on? Like how are these two things happening that like, A, you have children going in front of judges alone, and then you have judges who are basically just the prosecution dressed up in a dress.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, this is a fundamental flaw of the U.S. immigration legal system and has been for decades and decades. I mean, as far back as the 1920s and 30s, I did a deep dive archival research project last spring with students. This is a longstanding area of interest of mine. I mean, back in the 20s, people were writing about this and saying, why do we have these people deciding these immigration cases? And they're not impartial. They're not independent judges. This is crazy. This violates not just the principles and letter of American law, but like, to use this very problematic term, the Western legal tradition. That whole Western legal tradition is you have a separation between a prosecution and a judge. And the immigration courts have never really functioned like that. And it's been the judges themselves, actually, who in the course of defending the work that they do, and what the judges themselves see as the value of impartiality and the belief in those principles, whatever we may think of someone taking on a role where you're actually signing deportation orders, it's a problematic role in a problematic system. But they themselves have been the one to say, this needs to be independent. This is not a fair and just system. This does not live up to our ideals. And so it's been a longstanding problem. And so that combined with the fact that immigration courts are civil and not criminal courts, that's a thing that a lot of people on the right confuse. They think just because you are going in front of an immigration judge, you're a criminal. No, that a lot of these people are in the country legally. They're not in the country illegally. But because it's civil, there's no right to an attorney as you have in criminal court. So, you know, if you're 4 years old, 3 years old, 2 years old, and you have a deportation case and no one else, you know, you don't have anyone else to go there with you, somebody still has to bring you and you have to sit there. And I'm telling you, I've seen it. I spent a lot of my research years sitting in immigration court watching cases, and it is not unusual to see children sit up there by themselves. And it's getting even worse because of the way that the Trump administration is doing it. I mean, one thing is, even though this has always been true and it's always been tragic, the Trump administration, out of sheer cruelty, has terminated many of the programs that were there because Republicans and Democrats agree, like, okay, probably four-year-olds shouldn't be there, but we should probably have some programs. If you have to go to court as a four-year-old, there should probably be an advocate sitting next to you, or we should probably try to provide some minimal access to legal. No, the Trump administration says, no, we don't care about children. We're going to yank funding for those programs.
I mean, I will say it feels very typical Democrat to be like, we're not going to stop kids from having to appear in court by themselves, but you can bring a buddy that you just met 5 minutes ago. Like, that's fair. Like, what? Okay. I know that geography is also one of your wheelhouses. So I wanted to touch on this a moment, because I think like the way that we're taught about borders and geography is very like structured and very rigid, right? And yet in reality, borders are so, so fluid, so flimsy. And for quite some time now, the border of the U.S. in terms of legal rights has been smaller. It's pretty much exactly 100 miles inland from each border, land and water. Mm-hmm. And yet the stretch of U.S. surveillance and military power and violent power has extended far beyond our supposed geographical borders. Could you talk about this little accordion of the borders in terms of our rights and the rights of the state?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about borders is, as a political geographer, one of the ways that we like to think about it is, instead of thinking about what a border is, we ask, what does a border do? So what does a border do? In the case of the U.S. border, especially the U.S.-Mexico border, instead of thinking where the line is, it would say, well, how does the government, how does the state use the border as a mechanism for accomplishing other things? One of the things that the United States government has done for decades and decades and over a century is the government has said, okay, well, if you're close to the border or at the border, we don't think the Constitution really applies there as much as it applies other places. Well, that's kind of a weird thing, because, you know, you think about the Constitution, you think, okay, well, I'm on the line that's the United States border, or I'm inside the United States, obviously the Constitution will apply. Well, again, the government says, no, you're close to a border. And we're going to say that the border, instead of what it is, we're going to say that what the border does for us is the border allows us, speaking of the government, the border allows us to create this zone of exception where laws don't function the way you think they function. It's like some kind of like event horizon of the black hole, like physics stops to make sense, you know? And then once you normalize that though, then there's, you know, there's policy creep. So you say, okay, well, if the Constitution doesn't apply at the border, what does it apply 10 feet from the border? Well, it shouldn't apply 10 feet from the border either because you're pretty close. And then what about a mile? What about 10 miles? What about 100 miles? And so what happens is the border gives states in certain circumstances, states can exploit borders to create these kinds of practices and industries. I mean, you know this, it's because of all of this exceptionality that there's an entire, you know, industry around the border industrial complex that has all these. Well, once you have all of these contracts in place and technology and legal exceptions, why not just take all of that and go to Portland, Oregon, and go to Minneapolis, and go to Columbus, Ohio, and go to Washington, D.C., and apply all of those strategies and exceptions and technologies everywhere else? So that's kind of what we see with the border. The border is, it's a testing ground. It's a sandbox for civil rights violations and state violence, where it practices those things, normalizes them, gets good at them, and then moves them. It's like you mentioned, you know, the way that our law enforcement cross-train in Israel. It's this kind of policy diffusion. You go, and this is the critique of that exchange. The critique of that exchange with Israeli forces isn't that law enforcement should never train together. I mean, lots of law enforcement train together. But the reason that particular exchange is so problematic is they're going to a place because of the relationship between Israel and Palestinians. There's all of these exceptions built into the use of force and to law enforcement. And so our law enforcement learns all of these exceptional practices in this kind of zone of legal exception and then incorporates them back into U.S. policing. That's a very different context. And that's, you know, that's really problematic.
Yeah, it is. But also on brand, settler colonialists will flock together, I suppose, yes. Although it's not as sing-songy. But kind of wrapping up here, Austin, you had mentioned earlier that, you know, this kind of information that we can pull helps us better address situations in our communities. And I'm wondering, I know there's a lot of like know your rights trainings and there's anti-ICE or ICE watch groups and things like that. But what do you think, like, what kind of information do you feel, because there's so much information out there, what do you think that, or what areas do you think that organizers or community members should really be focusing on? Like, where do you think the most need is right now with regards to the immigration issue?
So a couple points, big picture, the little picture. Immigration is a very complex field. And in some ways, what Trump has been effective at is treating it like a very simple thing. It's very much a friend-enemy distinction. If you're a white U.S. citizen, you know, you are part of the United States. And if you don't belong to that, especially if you're an immigrant, you're the enemy. And the reality is that that is never how the immigration system has worked. Sure, you could say from a critical perspective, it's always had a kind of antagonism. But the reality is the law, the policy, the practice of immigration in the United States is much more complex. And one thing to just remember is immigration has never been just about the law. First of all, the law is very complicated. And most people who are posting on social media supporting ICE, all this maggot, like, they're like, don't you understand, like, these are illegal immigrants. Don't you understand what illegal means? I'm like, do you understand what illegal means? Because I don't think you do. So part of it is like, okay, let's just remind ourselves that this is actually a very complicated field, and don't let the Trump administration or Trump's rhetoric divide us or treat something that's really interesting and complex and beautiful as something simple and as pure antagonism. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say,
I don't know what's beautiful about it, but that's Austin Coker on Project Censored. Won't be able to get into the AI discussion where it talks about memes created to just for clickbait, not doing justice to it. I noticed that there's apparently an ice watch on I-57. Somebody took a picture of a semi loaded with ICE SUVs going north on I-55. I don't know if somebody followed them to see whether they took the turn to go to Chicago or whether they're going north to through Madison to more trucks going to Minneapolis. Something about know your rights. And if you heard the segment with Counter Spin earlier, suggested not taking your phones to demos. Well, if you do have to take your phone to a demo, You might want to turn off the facial or thumbprint recognition, because they're allowed to force you to look at your camera and open it for them. But if you can't, if it doesn't, your phone doesn't do that, you don't have to tap in the code. Details, details, details. Opinions are those of the speakers, and now we're going to get on to what I can play from the piece on cryptocurrency. Like I said, I've been listening to business news, Canadian news, through this period of tension between our friends to the north. And I noticed that the Conservative conference happened in Alberta, where there's a separatist movement, and Trump officials actually talked to the Alberta separatists. Trump really wants a 51st state, and Alberta, which has the tar sands, would probably be a good candidate for that. It's bizarre. And let's see, Trump's crypto embrace. I guess we're going to start with a quote from Trump here on this, and I'll play. This is from Lever Time. As I mentioned, the top, they have sort of a hybrid podcast model where I guess you can Patreon them and not listen to ads. It's a listener-supported thing. They've done some great work. I haven't been tracking them lately, but as I say, I've been listening to this business news, and crypto is just ubiquitous, and wanted to play something about it. I have somewhat in the last 4 months or so, but not lately. So we're going to an economic issue. The buzz is about the Federal Reserve. Apparently, Powell does not have to step down after he leaves the chair. He could stay on and muck things up a bit. I'm not lionizing him or the Fed. I think it's a tool of the banker class to a large extent. There's arguments within them. There was actually a segment on Economic Update with Richard Wolff that talked about interest rates, etc., this morning that was a good anecdote, but Trump just wants a sugar high for the time with the election cycle so that he can perhaps keep control of the House and the Senate. He's not thinking past that, I don't think, in my opinion. Oh, here's Ariel Moskowitz. Not sure on the name. Maybe she introduces herself here. No, this is Trump.
Bitcoin, it just seems like a scam.
That was Donald Trump on Fox News in 2021.
I don't like it because it's another currency competing against the dollar.
At the time, Bitcoin and the entire cryptocurrency industry was riding high. But sure enough, the crypto industry crashed in 2022, incinerating billions of dollars of investments.
Capitalism has its own pretty rapid cycles of boom and bust, it seems, but crypto's even faster. And I mean, a lot of people joke that crypto's been speed running the last like 500 years of capitalism.
That's Jacob Silverman. He's a journalist based in New York City.
In Brooklyn, of course, like everyone else.
Jacob writes about technology and the digital revolution of American democracy. His most recent book is called Gilded Rage, Elon Musk and the Radicalization of Silicon Valley.
This is about the rise of the tech right and the last election and basically how this new alignment between tech elites and MAGA came about.
Jacob started working on this book a few years ago when he had a hunch that Elon Musk would become involved in the 2024 election.
Yeah, seems like a huge understatement in retrospect.
Should have bet on it.
Yeah. I don't know if Polymarket was open then or not.
Jacob Silverman has been following tech's foray into politics for years. And he says this is the moment when everything really changed.
I'm thrilled to be here and to become the first American president ever to address a Bitcoin event anywhere in the world.
Trump's appearance at a Bitcoin conference in July of 2024, it marked the beginning of a new era. It was the moment Trump pledged his loyalty to the crypto industry.
I pledge to the Bitcoin community that the day I take the oath of office, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's anti-crypto crusade will be over. It will end. It'll be done.
That was a very dramatic and even triumphant moment for Trump.
The moment I'm sworn in, the persecution stops and the weaponization ends against your industry.
There's an element of kitsch to all this and silliness, both because it's crypto and it's Trump, of course, who's sort of like this prima donna would-be Broadway producer. But like, that was an important moment when he came out on stage for a very loyal crowd, but like newly loyal, like people who were sympathetic to him before, but now we're like, oh, you get us.
They're going to keep their hands off crypto. They're going to let it grow. We're going to let it grow on day one.
And he said all the things they wanted to hear, including that he would fire Gary Gensler.
Gary Gensler was President Biden's chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the government's head crypto cop.
I will fire Gary Gensler and appoint a new SEC chairman.
Gensler was seen as a tough enforcer. He brought lawsuits against industry giants Coinbase, Kraken, and Ripple Labs. He cost the crypto industry billions in penalties. And even Trump was a bit surprised by the room's vehement reaction.
I didn't know he was that unpopular.
And there was an interesting moment where he said, oh, you guys really like that. And he repeated himself.
Let me say it again. On day one, I will fire Gary Gensler.
Whoa. There is this way in which Trump understands like what some of his people want and like throws them that red meat.
I will appoint a new SEC chairman who believes America should build the future, not block the future, which is what they're doing.
Trump not only was converted on a policy level, but was converted as an entrepreneur and basically gave his sons the green light to jump into the deep end of crypto with its shadiest actors.
We'll get into that later. But to the crypto industry, Trump's speech meant salvation. Here is President Trump's AI and crypto czar, David Sacks, explaining his frustration with Biden-era regulations on crypto.
Basically, the whole crypto industry was in the process of moving offshore. And America, I think, was being deprived of this industry of the future.
I'm going to tell you how the crypto industry silenced skeptics and is pushing for a new set of rules. But first, and almost overnight, the equivalent of billions of dollars emerged out of thin air. By 2022, when Molly started writing about crypto, the catastrophic consequences of this boom were starting to emerge.
He was once hailed as the king of crypto. But today, Sam Bankman-Fried, founder and former CEO of crypto exchange FTX, is facing criminal indictments and a wave of civil complaints.
All it took was one market downturn to turn this golden token into digital toilet paper.
It's highly leveraged bets that it took on the markets, and we're now starting to see that unravel.
There was just disaster after disaster after disaster.
Molly was stunned by the lack of protection for investors. The world of crypto was the financial equivalent of the Wild West.
People, especially in the U.S., have become very comfortable with highly regulated financial systems, whether it's banks or brokerages, where you expect that things are going to more or less go as you believe they should go. You'll wake up tomorrow and your money should still be in the bank and your stocks should still be in your portfolio. I think it's really important that people understand that putting money into crypto is taking on quite a bit more risk than just potentially prices going down. Those protections do not exist, you know, values fluctuating, but you know, you very well might wake up tomorrow and find that your crypto wallet is empty.
But according to Jacob Silverman, the innovation that Sachs promised to crypto investors seems to be just novel ways for Trump to accept money from people looking for favors.
The Trump family has been kind of adept at riding all this stuff to becoming very rich, but also having this, what I've called like a Dropbox, this vehicle, World Liberty Financial, where anyone can put in money and try to bribe them.
World Liberty Financial is a crypto company that Trump, his family and close business partners, including Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, created shortly before the 2024 election. It's managed by Trump and Witkoff's sons. In many ways, World Liberty Financial is like any other crypto startup.
There's no innovation here or anything like that, except the presidential family is attached. They have issued a couple main tokens, and then you saw a lot of foreign money pouring in, famously from Justin Sun.
Justin Sun, a Chinese-born crypto billionaire, invested millions in World Liberty Financial shortly after Trump won the presidential election. Afterwards, it was reported that the Securities and Exchange Commission paused their investigation into Sun's companies for securities fraud.
Which was pretty incredible, because if you ever read any of the filings, like, they had a lot there against him.
The SEC would go on to dismiss investigations into crypto giants Coinbase, Ripple, and Kraken.
Many such cases, as they say.
And while the cases investigating crypto companies are being dismissed, President Trump has pardoned actual crypto criminals.
He had a lot of support, and they said that what he did is not even a crime.
I'm going to tell you how the crypto industry... But according to Jacob Silverman, the innovation that Sachs promised to crypto investors seems to be just novel ways for Trump to accept money from people looking for favors.
I guess that was worth repeating. Sorry, my finger. Hasn't been doing the walking very carefully here. We only have a couple of seconds left in the show, so... Let's hear the concluding segments of this from Lever Time, David Sirota's great podcast.
He promised basically to provide this clarity so that the industry understand what the rules are, be able to comply.
Clarity. That's the word David Sachs, Trump's crypto czar, uses when he talks about proper legislation to regulate crypto.
In turn, that gives, or that should provide, greater protection for consumers and businesses, everyone who's part of the ecosystem.
The Digital Asset Market Clarity Act, often called the Clarity Act, passed in the House last summer. That market structure bill is now going through revisions in the Senate, and it's a subject of a lot of drama. The industry giant Coinbase recently withdrew its support for the bill, clashing with the traditional banking lobby.
The crypto industry, I mean, has really been lobbying in practically every arena that is crypto related.
That's crypto journalist Molly White again. She told me that a market structure bill is very necessary to set the ground rules for crypto and clear up any legal gray areas.
The market structure bill is aimed at tackling broader questions just around how cryptocurrency is regulated. The CFTC, the Department of Justice even, has made significant changes to its priorities around crypto crime. Essentially making things much, much easier for crypto companies, which previously were operating, I think, you know, in the most generous interpretation, in a very gray area of the law. I think more critical people would say that it was a fairly clear violation of the law, but the crypto industry has at least maintained that there was just no clarity, and so they were doing the best they could.
What's important is the crypto industry is seeking federal guidelines on how to do business, but the industry is also helping write those guidelines.
I think we've got a chance to do a new draft and hopefully get back into a markup in a few weeks.
That's the CEO of Coinbase, Brian Armstrong, who's aiming to help rewrite the bill. And Molly pointed out, the goal of the Clarity Act is to create a clear path for crypto to work its way into mainstream finance.
We're seeing pension funds investing in cryptocurrency, for example. There have been concerns raised by various labor unions that their employees, the workers that they represent, are potentially exposed to crypto even without having any crypto holdings of their own.
People may not own crypto or may not think they're exposed to crypto, but they will be.
That's Jacob Silverman again. As crypto companies win legal legitimacy,
your retirement account is going to buy shares of MicroStrategy, which is like this highly leveraged company that only owns crypto.
Right now, the Clarity Act is in limbo, but its sister law has already kicked in. Last year, the Genius Act was signed into law. The Genius Act allows banking and non-banking institutions to issue a kind of cryptocurrency called stablecoin, which is tied to the value of the U.S. dollar.
That means that, like, any authoritarian country or criminal organization from overseas could buy as many like of these kind of fake dollars from Trump as they want. Like, they could give him billions and billions.
Jacob Silverman argues that the rise of stablecoin could usher us into a new era of bribery, where crypto, acting like cash, can be exchanged with limited regulation. But the Genius Act also does something else. It's bankifying crypto.
The Genius Act is starting to strip away at this core pillar of our regulatory system we've had for hundreds of years, which is if you are a bank, you're regulated differently than if you are just a regular commercial entity. And you can't be both because that's too much power.
That's the Lever's reporter, Luke Goldstein, who was on Lever Time last year talking about the Genius Act.
It's essentially legalizing larger investors to feel comfortable putting their money into crypto markets.
Luke,
okay, that's Lever Time, an episode, what is it titled? what tech wants, the crypto reign of terror, with Jacob Silberman and Molly White, as well as some other journalists. Well done, well crafted. Maybe this is another reason, besides the possibility of the AI bundle, that the Federal Reserve of New York has opened the window and billions of dollars have been going into the banks, perhaps protecting themselves against this insolvency. Apparently, you can get a loan collateralized by crypto for U.S. dollars. That sounds like a great idea for the banks. But, yeah, full of great ideas. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. I already did a couple of underwriting announcements, so let's go right to Funkadelic with the Radio Free Labor about to cut loose.